Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm Craig Box.
And I'm Adam Glick.
Adam, they tell me you've had a colorful weekend.
Look at you with the clever puns. Yes, I decided to start playing around with the Hue lighting system. I don't know if you have one of those, but I picked one up and started tinkering with it. And the API is super easy to use. And much to the chagrin of my wife, I just started flipping lights on and off around the house in order to kind of play with it and figure some stuff out. So I'm starting to think about some of the stuff that I could build as kind of dashboards and retro style displays to build off of things. It's a lot of fun. I was pretty impressed.
How many light bulbs do you have?
Oh my gosh, right now? I have 13 of them, I think. Lucky 13.
Wow, that's a lot. They come in the pack of two to start with, don't they?
You can get them in ones, you can get them in four packs.
Or you can clearly buy them in bulk.
Cheaper by the dozen, as they say.
I don't know. Like, again, I've not seen your house. What's the scale? Is that every light bulb in your house, or is that just like your workroom with its 13 light fittings?
It is not, but a lot of our fixtures have three light bulb pieces. So
I see.
You know, if you haven't played with it, it's just they've done a really nice job for IoT lights, and it plugs in with, you know, all the other home automation stuff I have, which pretty much is a clarion call to any hacker out there to go start, you know, making my house turn into a strobe light, but some pretty cool stuff.
And the back end runs on Kubernetes, on GKE.
That's right.
I thought that was why we were talking about it.
Indeed. And I believe that we're actually going to get together in person next week to record a rare show in person.
Yes, every now and then, Adam's and my paths collide. And next week, we are at Google Cloud Next in Tokyo. So if you are a Japanese listener and you have not yet signed up, I think there's still a few tickets available on the website. Feel free to drop by. I'll give a little talk on the Istio ecosystem, and you'll be able to see Adam and I at the GKE Hybrid Orchestra booth on the show floor.
Yep. And we may even have stickers by that point. So stop by and get a sticker.
I look forward to giving those away.
Let's get to the news.
Cisco Hybrid Cloud Platform for Google Cloud is now generally available. CHCPFGC, with three Cs, can be installed in your data center and supported by Cisco, and complements GKE, providing Kubernetes, Istio, and the GCP service catalog. Submissions are now being taken for the Cisco and Google Cloud Challenge, where you can win buckets of cloud credits and tickets to Cisco Live 2019 in Barcelona by showing off your solution running on the Cisco Hybrid Cloud Platform.
HashiCorp made a number of announcements around integration of their console plus Kubernetes to be made available in the coming weeks. This includes an official Helm chart for installing console on Kubernetes, automatic bidirectional syncing of Kubernetes services with console, and some more Istio-like features for console connect, including pod injection and support for Envoy as the proxy. HashiCorp also says that an official Vault Helm chart is coming and confirms that the releases have no impact on its support of its own Nomad container system.
Google Cloud and video game engine company Unity this week announced OpenMatch, an open-source game matchmaking service that runs on Kubernetes. Matchmaking need not be just being assigned to 99 substantially lower-ping teenagers to pwn you at Fortnite. Instead, OpenMatch supports matching based on latency, wait time, and an arbitrary skill rating. Once you've matched players, you need to pass that information to a multiplayer game server, and for scaling those, there is Agones, a collaboration between Google Cloud and Ubisoft, which this week has released version 0.4.
In self-driving Kubernetes news, Couchbase, an open-source NoSQL database, introduced version 1.0 of its autonomous Kubernetes operator. One user claims it reduced their administrative overhead by 80%, but no word on if you have to keep your hands on the steering wheel at all times while using it.
AWS has announced that Amazon EKS is now available in Ireland, bringing the available worldwide region count to 3. In related news, Google Cloud has just launched a new region in Finland, and GKE is available there from day one, bringing the available region count to 17, or in other words, all of them.
Kubernetes as a service vendor, Platform 9, has introduced support for arbitrage in their cross-platform, in their platform. Arbitrage helps you deal with the confusion of the AWS spot market by finding regions with cheaper nodes when they are available and can still run to meet your target SLA. Their cost calculation logic for the consistently priced Google Cloud preemptible VMs should be a lot easier when they implement this feature for other clouds as promised.
External DNS, a project in the Kubernetes incubator, has released 0.5.6. External DNS is like kubeDNS in that it publishes endpoints for Kubernetes services, but instead of running a DNS server and publishing them internally, it uses provider APIs to enter their information into external DNS services like Google Cloud DNS or Route 53. The new release adds support for Alibaba Cloud and using the Istio gateway as a source.
Finally, Red Hat continues its blogging about Kubernetes being the next generation of application servers. Starting a new series on the topic, Ken Finnegan talks about how Kubernetes can be the application server of the future. The article covers some basics about container usage and their benefits. It might be a good intro if you're new to the containerized infrastructure space.
And that's the news.
Justin Garrison is a senior systems engineer working in the media industry, which means you'll find his name in IMDb. He's the co-author of a book called Cloud Native Infrastructure and enjoys helping people and learning new things. Welcome, Justin.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
So, Justin, I understand this is not your first podcast experience.
No, it's not. Way back in the day, I used to help run a podcast called the Mintcast, which was the Linux Mint community podcast with a couple people from the community.
So that must have been quite a way back in the day. That was 13 years ago?
Yeah, that was quite a while ago. Yeah, I actually...
Does make you a podcast pioneer?
Maybe. I had started recording that podcast before I had ever actually listened to a podcast. I didn't really know what they were, but I thought we'd figure it out. So.
Fair enough. Well, it's still running today, so you must have done something right.
Yeah, I'm really glad to see the community kept doing it.
So obviously that's an early experience with both technology and community. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the technology.
Yeah, I mean, I've always kind of just been a tinkerer with things, kind of take things apart and try to figure out how they work, whether it was technology or not. And really, it kind of led me, you know, more and more into figuring things out and learning things. And someone's like, hey, you have experience with this thing. So, you know, kind of become an expert in one thing or another. And that led me through various stages of my career as far as working with computers and working with software and just kind of figuring things out as I went.
How did you come to Kubernetes as part of your software journey?
That was kind of just a progression of career-wise as far as starting in operations, kind of figuring things out and working on them, and did a lot with automating things with software and was doing kind of the DevOps scene with config management and helping people like manage servers and really make it repeatable and kind of always the same, so it was less of a surprise when they'd go to work. And that progressed pretty naturally into kind of doing things with the containers and then figuring out that managing more than, you know, a dozen or two containers is kind of hard for people. And so looking into different orchestration engines and figuring out like how these things can be run better for people to kind of interface with them and manage larger scale systems. And so I started off doing a lot with, not a lot, but looking into Mesosphere and Swarm and Nomad, and then kind of progressed into figuring out Kubernetes and understanding kind of how it worked together and then just seeing why it was designed certain ways and then how to extend that and use it.
And as you work with the community, what parts of the project do you get involved with? Obviously, it's a large community with a lot of different pieces. What areas do you like to engage?
Yeah, it's definitely grown quite big. I tend to kind of go on the operator side of it as far as making it useful and understanding how people that kind of manage the system and how they kind of set up Kubernetes in general, where you can have it just free range for anyone to kind of play with it. But there are best practices for how to extend it when you're actually making things like operators or controllers or APIs, why it's useful to kind of build some of that stuff in. So it is more on the back end of things to make the consumers of that product easier, where there's a lot of developers, there's a lot of, you know, people doing a lot with Helm and all these other things to package applications. And I've messed with some of that stuff just to understand like their use cases. But a lot of the time I kind of stay on the backside of why you would extend Kubernetes and how to use it to like its best, you know, how it was designed. You don't want to go too far out of the bounds. Otherwise, you can just make this crazy snowflake of a cluster.
Now, you've codified a lot of your learnings into the book Cloud Native Infrastructure, which you wrote with Chris Nova. Tell us a little bit about how you got to writing that.
Yeah, it was really kind of a surprise, I suppose.
Just one day you woke up and you'd written the book.
It was a lot of work. I do have a blog post kind of outlining a lot of the work that went into it as far as how much time it took and just the process with O'Reilly. But someone else inside the Kubernetes community has written a few different books, Sebastian, and he reached out to me and asked, he said, my editor is looking for someone else to write a book on this topic. And really it was focused around the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, the CNCF projects. To figure out like how people should piece them together and what they're good for. And so we kind of started down that path because I was involved with the CNCF as well. I'm a CNCF ambassador. And it sounded really interesting. And it was kind of a passion that I had been doing. And my involvement directly with Kubernetes was kind of slowing down at the time. So I thought I could take what I've learned and kind of turn that into something else that a lot of other people can learn from. And going through that process, definitely, you know, talked to people that had written books and recommended getting a co-author, and having Chris co-author that with me was great because the book is so much better because she was involved and was able to bring insights that she had from doing large scale systems. And she was a maintainer of COPS at the time, the Kubernetes deployment for Amazon. And so her insights there and patterns she had learned were just great to have as part of the book in general.
Is this the first book that you've written?
Yes, it's the first book. It was about a year of work to kind of go through the whole thing and figure out. And it changed a lot. I mean, we had the first half draft done, really focusing on the CNCF projects, and realized that it was already out of date. And the project really didn't matter. The technologies themselves weren't important. It was really the patterns
yes.
around like how things work a certain way at scale, having declarative APIs and really making what we coined as infrastructure as software, where instead of infrastructure as code, you know, a directory full of JSON files doesn't help you as much, but software running that actually manages your infrastructure, that helped a lot more. And that was the pattern we saw from interviewing people at like Netflix and Google and Amazon. And those patterns were more powerful for people managing this infrastructure.
How has life changed for you as the author of this book? Do people come up to you at conferences and ask you to sign copies?
We have had a couple of signings, thankfully sponsored by CNCF and some other companies, which was fantastic. It's really great to have like a physical thing that I made that is very tangible to hand to someone and really help them learn something. And that's just great to be able to like pour a year of my work into like condensing that as much as possible into like, this is what I think is important. This is how I think that people can become better versions of themselves in operations as a developer, as an engineer, to understand these patterns. And they don't have to do all that work. They have to do the work of reading the book and hopefully understand some of that stuff. And that's been great.
Adam, we should get some episodes of this podcast printed on 8-track and we should hand them out at conferences. I think that's very tangible.
I'll put that right next to our plan for reel-to-reel distribution and cuneiform tablet shipping. Do you think you'll do a V2 of the book?
I'd love to keep it updated because a lot of things have even changed in the last year. More things are being learned and there's a lot more that could be added as far as extending what's in there. We really distilled a lot of it down to fairly short chapters just to not make it too lengthy for people and not make it just like drone on because there was no reason to like just add words. And so we really wanted to condense it as much as possible, but there are new insights on how people are being successful with this infrastructure. And it's not always just Kubernetes. It's, you know, the pattern there of having infrastructure software and using cloud environments in general continuously evolves. And so it would be interesting to definitely keep it up to date.
You've talked about your journey through operations and coming to Kubernetes, and you've also mentioned that you wrote the book kind of thinking about that perspective. And I hear a lot of discussion about operators and also about developers and how both of them are using Kubernetes. I'm curious if you think about it from the operator perspective, what are things that people should think about as they're kind of taking on Kubernetes? What are the challenges that they would kind of uniquely run into and they should be thinking about as they're getting into Kubernetes and using it?
Yeah, I think operators are kind of mandated differently than engineers in some cases, where they are, you know, managing this base infrastructure for where the value is to the business. And it's always kind of hard to kind of balance that role of saying like, well, this needs to be stable and can't ever change. And it's a hard place to kind of be with, okay, well, I need to always keep things the same because I can't change them, but I also need to advance them and make them better for people. And looking at Kubernetes as another tool that you can use where, you know, people are using Bash, they're using config management, they're using all these things that they're used to. And whether those are simple or not, I mean, everyone's kind of comfortable with their own level of complexity where, I mean, I've written Bash scripts that are horribly complex, but I understand them. So it's totally fine. And I really don't care how complex it is because I understand it. And Kubernetes might be a different set of complexities that you're bringing into it, but using that as a tool just to say, okay, well, I have to understand some basics here and understand why I would use this thing and when. And then once you kind of get comfortable with that level, really figuring out how to add value and not necessarily focusing on just the technology and just the lower level, like no business or no one really gets benefit out of just running Kubernetes. Like you have to put some on it. You have to get value out of that thing. And the value usually is from, you know, faster iterations, from big, larger scale, from all these things that Kubernetes enables, but this tool itself isn't necessarily valuable unless of course maybe you're selling that to someone else. But even then you need to be able to iterate because it moves so quickly. Kubernetes isn't standing still. And if you take all this time, spin it up and okay, I have this thing now, it's going to change in 3 to 6 months. And you need to keep up if you want to keep getting more value out of it.
Do you think that the release cycle is too quick? Do you think we should be looking as a community at 9-month releases or 18-month LTS releases?
I think it's too quick for people that want to maintain systems in a traditional way. Like again, that conflict of keeping things stable versus, you know, making things better or getting new features is definitely in conflict. But I think as much as possible, when people ask me, like, how should I get started? I usually tell them just find a hosted solution. Like, don't run it yourself because you're not going to get as much value. Like, if you need to extend it and you can't on some hosted platform, maybe you'll get more value out of doing it yourself. But in general, you can go, you know, use GKE and guess what? They'll upgrade it for you. And you don't have to worry about all those pieces, but you can add value on top of it by extending it or figuring out the workflows for people to get stuff into it and make value for whatever you're doing.
You've talked about how you're making people successful. I also know that at one point you gave a very interesting talk talking about the challenges that people can have and how Kubernetes adoption could potentially fail. I was wondering if you could share some of your learnings on what it means to make sure that people are successful with Kubernetes adoption, because some of those are technical. And I remember you mentioned that some of those pieces might not have been.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's like the hardest thing in technology is the people by far. And it turns out that the most important thing in technology is the people. And it's totally worth focusing on the people aspect of it, on how this tool enables people to work better, whether that's better workflows, whether that's, you know, better tooling for them or better just visibility into what's going on, because these systems are so abstract where it's, you know, a server is running 100 instances of this pod. Like, how do you know when something's broken? And there's all these things that Kubernetes kind of enhances and brings back to operators and developers. And in the book, I just generically always call people engineers because we're always engineering something. It doesn't matter if you're an operator or a developer. You have some insight that you want to get out of the system and some workflow that you want to improve by using this tool. And really, I mean, that's the key for me that I've kind of learned talking to a lot of people, is just focusing on the people, their workflows, and how they get work done, and improving that stuff is a much better focus than just focusing on the technology and saying, we need Kubernetes because it's Kubernetes and everyone's doing it.
Looking at the landscape of CNCF projects, is there anything that you feel is missing? You talk about the human challenges. Are there any projects perhaps around workflow or anything that you think that, if you could wave a magic wand over the cloud native community and introduce another project, what area do you think that project would be in?
It's funny you mentioned that. I gave a talk at Scale about that landscape. And I was pointing out that, like, I really think the landscape sucks because it's not meant for engineers to look at. It's not like you shouldn't be, you know, doing cloud native roulette and like picking your projects out of that. It's really meant for marketing and for being able to see how big the landscape is, because there's value in people getting involved, but it's not for engineers to go out there and pick things out. And really the whole thing is just tools. You can use all these different tools in different ways, finding the right tool for the job. And that was really the SoCal Linux Expo, like my whole talk was about that. And I actually added an icon to the landscape and asked someone to point out, like, which icon did I add? And really it was the cloud native infrastructure book. And it was hilarious because it's like, well, there's the one thing, like, documentation is missing from this thing on how to use this stuff. But really, I mean, treating all that stuff as just tools, and you can pick one, figure out if it's the right thing for you. I mean, go to any toolbox and see, like, oh, well, do I need the, you know, Phillips screwdriver or a hammer? It's like, they're completely different things. Can you do the same thing with both tools? Probably. You might hurt yourself, but using the right tool for the job is important.
So would you recommend that people who are currently working on tools down those tools for a while and focus more on documentation?
I would definitely recommend people learn why tools were made and the history around that. You can look at a white paper for, say, the Raft protocol and understand from the white paper why they designed Raft and what the trade-offs they had were. And then from there, you can say, okay, well, it was built off Raft. And, okay, well, I want to use etcd because it was based on Raft. Or you can look at Gossip protocol and say, oh, well, you know what? Like, the Gossip protocol white paper is completely different trade-offs than what Raft had. And so I might want to use Consul over etcd because of why those tools were created and the trade-offs they made. And so understanding the history of some of those tools is more important than just like seeing, oh, well, Kafka is a streaming, can do things on streams, so that's what I want, right? Well, like, there's other things that do things on streams. Like, it might be a better tool. And so a lot of times, yeah, focus on, try something out, see if it is the right tool, understand the history of that tool, and then figure out if that's the right thing for you going forward for whatever you're trying to do.
I believe the Raft paper is a lot more accessible than the Paxos paper, for example. Do you think that the implementations of things, do you think people will adopt them more because the quality of the technical communication is better?
I definitely see the benefit of allowing people to understand difficult technologies more. There is a tipping point when once there's buy-in on a certain thing, there's just kind of this, you know, landfall of people that just go that direction because everyone else did it. It is a hard place to be because it could be successful for them. They could get in trouble. But I definitely think, especially for the early adopters, yeah, like early in that like hype curve, is important to make it as accessible and understandable for people of what the trade-offs are and why it was designed. Which again, for me, like getting into Kubernetes, those were really hard things. It was actually why I started with like Swarm. I started Swarm because like, this is amazing. It's easy to get installed and it was up and running and it was just great. And then I had the benefit of actually spending an afternoon with Kelsey Hightower, and like he explained so much to me through that of like why certain things were designed and how to extend them and what the benefits might be. And that was really eye-opening for me to kind of dig into Kubernetes from then.
What's coming next in Kubernetes that you're excited about?
I'm actually excited about the pace that Kubernetes is keeping up with on releases based on time, I think are a great thing for the community and for the project and not based on features, because it does force you to kind of manage Kubernetes differently, where you can't spend a year to spin up this thing and understand it and get it just right. And then you're like, wow, you're four versions behind now. And you can't do that anymore. And treating this stuff even more so like you have to continuously improve it and continually bring in changes might be really difficult for people's workflows. I totally get that. And in those cases, I say as much as possible, use a hosted solution and just run with it. And you add value on top. But for people that are doing it manually and stuff, they need to really figure out how that workflow changes and understand, or at least enable the operators to make those changes quickly and be a little comfortable with risk. And looking back at like error budgets and SRE principles of like, when things go down, like what do we actually do with that? And not just, okay, let's put out fires all the time, but how do we improve things to make them more reliable and resilient?
After people have read your book, Cloud Native Infrastructure, what's the next thing you recommend that they do to keep up with what's going on at that community pace?
If it's specific Kubernetes, I mean, the working group, the SIGs and the special interest groups and the working groups are great places to get started just to kind of get a little focus on something where you can't take on the full fire hose. It's just way too much. You're going to be in SIG meetings and work groups all the time. And you can't go in Slack. Last I looked in Slack, there's like 32,000 people in there. It's like, there's no way that you're going to be able to like constantly keep up with that.
Is there a curated version of what's going on that you find valuable personally?
Yeah, actually.
Besides a podcast, because obviously that's the best place to start. But
if you have a way to listen to these podcasts, it's great. Like the news segments on this podcast.
Yeah, we have 8-track players. That's how people keep up with them.
There's actually on discuss.kubernetes forums, I forget who it is. Josh does a really good This Week in Kubernetes. And I get those emails, which are great because it's just a curated list of, there's one for development and kind of just like what's going on. If you really want to know what features are coming way in the future, he has some important pull requests and it's kind of what was discussed in some of the SIGs he's in. That's a great place. It's like an overview that is a curated list. And I really enjoy those. But then, yeah, if you want like a specialty, I think getting involved in one of the SIGs, whether that's in Kubernetes specifically, or you can go to the CNCF also has their SIGs for things like serverless and storage and that kind of stuff. You can get involved in whatever you think will differentiate your business and focus on that thing as a differentiator and then get involved in learn more from it. And then also, you know, push back and show what your workload might be and how it might be different for you.
And if you want to hear more from the author of the Last Week in Kubernetes newsletter, Josh Berkus, you can hear from him on episode 10 of this podcast, which you can download from kubernetespodcast.com or buy from your favorite 8-track store.
Speaking of keeping in touch and keeping up to date on things, if folks listening want to kind of keep in touch with you and follow what you've been doing, the publications, the talking you've been doing, what's the best way for people to follow you?
Yeah, I'm probably most active on Twitter. I have taken a step back from that fairly recently, just kind of muting some of my notifications. There's just kind of too much going on. But I'm Rothgar on Twitter, R-O-T-H-G-A-R. And then also my blog, justingarrison.com, just goes to a Medium blog where I post some things. It's usually around, at least lately, it's been more Kubernetes stuff and just cloud native things, kind of help people figure out some of the problems that I hear repeatedly, either something that I learned or I hear a lot from the community. I try to pull some of it up there. But again, it's like the project moves so fast and the community moves so fast. Some of that stuff is out of date quickly. And so, you know, keeping up with a stream is probably closer to Twitter streams.
What is a Hrothgar?
It's actually the king from Beowulf, the old story, which was, for me, he spells it with an H, and I was in high school when I came up with this name and didn't like the silent H. But I actually like the message around the story where the king gave his life for his people to survive from this dragon, essentially. So there was a movie at the time called The 13th Warrior, which was also out in my high school. We were the warriors. So it was kind of, I was number 13. It all kind of made sense in high school, and it just kind of, I went with it since then.
It's not a Beowulf cluster joke.
No, they do kind of go in, you know, in tandem, but I didn't learn about Beowulf clusters till much later.
All right, Justin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Take care.
It only remains for me to thank you for listening. If you'd like to thank us back, a really easy way to help us be discovered by more people is to pick up your podcast player and rate us. Use iTunes or whatever it is that you use. If you're listening to us on the web, all episodes are this great and you should really subscribe.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod or reach us by email, KubernetesPodcast@google.com. You can find the show notes with all the links at KubernetesPodcast.com. Until next time, take care.
See you in Japan.